thanks very much for joining me again.
I'm James Curran. I'm Professor of Modern History here at Sydney University and also the International Editor at the Australian Financial Review, where I write regularly about Australia in world affairs. In the next few episodes, I'll be looking at how Australia responded to the two great defining developments which dominated Australia's international environment from the end of the Second World War until the end of the 1960s. The first of these was the coming of the Cold War to Asia, and the second, the Asian and African people's struggle for national independence. Now, in the aftermath of the Second World War, tensions arose between the Western powers and their erstwhile ally, the Soviet Union. And these antagonisms became institutionalized in the policies of confrontation and containment, which defined the Cold War. The world was divided into two opposing ideological camps: the West, or free world, led by the United States on one side, and the East, or the communist bloc, led by the Soviet Union on the other. This gave shape to international politics, and it affected the whole globe, including Australia. Now, at least on the surface, the Cold War was, unlike World Wars I and II, an ideological rather than a nationalist struggle. But as I suggested to you earlier in this series, the Americans and the Russians identified their own nationalisms with these ideologies, and so the Cold War was also a struggle between the two superpower nation-states and their respective allies. Nevertheless, the ideological dimension did matter. It bound the respective alliances more firmly together, and also created fifth columns in each camp. Among the many repressed nationalities in the Soviet Union and its Eastern European Empire, as well as among Russian dissidents, there were individuals who looked to the free world to free them from communist tyranny. Likewise, the communist parties in the Western countries were potential enemies within the gate. In Australia, one communist party leader declared in 1948, he said,
"If Australia was involved in a war with the Soviet Union, it would be a war between Soviet Russia and American and British imperialism."
And in that case, he said,
"We, that is Australian communists, would fight on the side of the Soviet Union."
At least two Communist Party members or sympathisers in the External Affairs Department, what the Department of Foreign Affairs was called in those days, provided copies of secret Australian and British documents to the KGB reps in the Soviet embassy in Canberra. The other major development of this period, which I will deal with in a later episode, is of course the struggle of the Asian and African peoples to free themselves from European imperial hegemony. And this also had important consequences for Australia and its foreign and defence policy. And as we'll see in that episode, the realisation of the Asian, especially Southeast Asian peoples' ambitions for national independence has had a lasting effect on Australia's relations with the region. The immediate impact on Australia was disturbing. Infected by the nationalist spirit of their Western masters, the colonised peoples demanded the right of self-determination and showed that they were willing to pay as high a price for this as the Western powers had in World War I and World War II. The indigenous resistance to the return of the Dutch, French, American and British empires and the Asian peoples' subsequent success in establishing their national independence transformed the political nature of the region, and it forced Australia to find new policies to meet the new circumstances. So what I'm saying is that these two big developments were interconnected, but I want to separate them, and in this episode I'll look at Australia's response to the Cold War and later on at the Australian response to the Asian independence movements and their ramifications. So let's look now at how Australia reacted to the global Cold War and how the Australian government related to use Prime Minister Robert Menzies' phrase, its great and powerful friends, especially the United States. Now first, I'm going to look at how the chiefly Labor government at the end of the Second World War responded to the challenges of the post-war world, especially the coming of the Cold War to Europe. Secondly, I'll look at how, as a result of the extension of the Cold War to Asia, Australia finally achieved what it had long sought, that is, a security treaty with the United States. The chiefly Labor government and the onset of the Cold War. Now, the Pacific War, especially Japan's downward thrust to Australia's borders and Britain's failure to send a fleet to Singapore, made a great impact on Australia. In its aftermath, chiefly Labor government was centrally concerned to protect Australia from a possible resurgence of Japanese imperialism. The Australian authorities had been dismayed by the ease with which the Japanese had been able to conquer the British, French, Dutch, Portuguese and American empires in the region. These would-be Western bulwarks against Asian threats had fallen like ninepins before the Japanese military onslaught. So the Australian government's initial post-war plan was to create a string of naval and air bases in the islands to the north and northeast of the continent, from the Dutch East Indies, as it was known, through Portuguese Timor to French New Caledonia. Australia's territory in New Guinea would be the anchor part for this rampart wall. None of the powers concerned were, however, willing to allow the Australians to set up these bases. And Britain was not willing to use its influence to persuade them, and so the first strategy never got off the ground. As the end of the war drew near, the Australian government became agitated about the failure of its great power allies to consult about the peace terms, and therefore about Australia's Pacific security. At the Cairo conference in December 1943, when Churchill, Franklin, Roosevelt and the Chinese leader Chiang Kai-shek announced the peace terms for the Pacific, the Australians heard about their decisions from the press. The Australians were further alarmed by the American Navy's public declaration that the United States intended, after the war, to keep the great naval base it had built on Manus Island, which was part of Australia's mandated territory. Now, in retaliation, Dr. Herbert Veer Evatt, then Australia's Minister for External Affairs, without informing the British or the Americans, held a conference with his New Zealand counterpart. What came from it was the so-called ANZAC Agreement, where the Australians and New Zealanders set out their claims to participate in the peacemaking and their proposals for the security and welfare of the Southwest Pacific. That agreement challenged the Americans head-on. It denied that any country had the right to retain bases on Australian or New Zealand territory after the war. And Canberra and Wellington asserted their joint responsibility for what they called regional zones of defence comprising the Southwest and South Pacific. That was to extend through an arc of islands north and northeast of Australia to Western Samoa and the Cook Islands. In essence, it was basically a reaffirmation of the Australian colonies' Pacific policy at the end of the 19th century. Because, as the British High Commissioner in Canberra observed of the ANZAC Pact, he said, it amounted to
a proposal to establish a Munro Doctrine
for the South Pacific. Furthermore, the ANZAC Agreement called on the US and UK and other European powers with colonies in the region to meet in conference to discuss the security and welfare of these islands. But once again, Australia was rebuffed. The Americans resented the criticism and were highly indignant at the smaller powers' presumption, and they would not participate in a conference based on the ANZAC Agreement. All of Australia's efforts to influence its great allies proved futile. As Evatt told the American diplomat in Canberra, he said Australia
felt very much alone in the Pacific.
During the next 4 years, the Australian government went to great lengths in trying to secure itself against the revival of Japanese militarism. Firstly, by trying to establish a defence alliance or arrangement with Britain and New Zealand, but most importantly, the United States. And secondly, by trying to ensure that through the peace treaty, Japan would be permanently disarmed. In early 1946, the Australian, New Zealand and British leaders meeting in London agreed that they should try to persuade the United States to join them in a defence alliance for the Pacific. As the Second World War had shown, only American power was adequate to guarantee Australia's security. And for this purpose, Evatt made many trips to the United States. In his desperate efforts to obtain some kind of promise of aid from America, he first sought a mutual defence alliance. When that was knocked back, he sought an agreement for mutual use of bases in the Pacific, which would warn possible enemies that there was tacit cooperation between the United States and the British Commonwealth. When that failed, he sought a presidential statement of support, but that too went the way of all the previous efforts. The Americans saw no point in taking on commitments in the South Pacific when they had no interests and saw no threat. Japan, under their control, was no longer a source of anxiety. As time went by, though, what concerned the Americans more and more was Soviet expansionism in Northeast Asia. In dealing with post-war Japan, Britain and New Zealand had agreed that Australia should represent the British Commonwealth on the Far Eastern Commission in Washington and on the Allied Council in Tokyo. These were the two bodies established to guide the demilitarisation and the democratisation of Japan. They recognised that since Australia carried the risks for the region, it should have the responsibility. Once again, however, Evatt found his objectives frustrated. In early 1947, the Americans proposed to hold a peace conference, and Evatt feared that as events were unfolding, The United States might concede a soft peace in order to gain Japan's support against the Soviet Union. And so Evatt was most anxious that the conference be held without delay. But by the end of that year, the United States had changed its mind, fearing that a conference with Russia present would be an embarrassment. Washington believed it needed a longer period to bring the Japanese on side in the global struggle with the Soviet Union. Evatt was infuriated. So the coming of the Cold War was, from Australia's point of view, an obstacle to achieving its security aims. So in January 1948, when the British government approached all the Commonwealth Prime Ministers to ask for their support for a Western Union aimed at containing the Soviet Union in Europe, Australia was the only government to refuse its assent. Explaining its objections, the Australian government took its stand on the liberal internationalist principles of the United Nations Charter. It maintained that an anti-Soviet pact would be contrary to the collective security principle of the Charter. It would be a return to selfish alliances and power politics. Such a scheme for Australia represented a return to diplomacy based on strategy and expediency rather than justice. It would have the effect of confirming Soviet suspicions of the West and consolidate the bipolarity which endangered world peace. Now, Evatt had taken a prominent role in the making of the United Nations Charter. While undoubtedly his judicial background made him sympathetic to the liberal international principles underpinning it, remember, he played a part in the framing of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It was also the case that his major interest at the San Francisco conference was to enhance the position of the lesser powers as opposed to the greater powers. Indeed, he maintained that great powers were the instruments of power politics and the cause of war. And therefore, if the lesser powers had more say in the world body, then justice and peace would have a better chance. Now, that hostility to great powers is not an intrinsic part of liberal internationalist theory. Evatt's attitude could perhaps be seen as a reaction to the difficulties he had encountered in dealing with the great powers on questions of the Japanese peace and Australia's security. It's also worth noting that in their reply to this British invitation, the Australians blamed the Americans rather than the British for this initiative. What I would argue is that the Australian government's liberal internationalist argument against the British proposal sounds a bit hollow. Just because a government uses liberal international type language does not mean that it is describing their motives. So what's the problem with the Australian arguments? Why should we not accept face value the claims that they're taking their stand in defence of the UN Charter? Well, let's deal with three issues. Firstly, the attack on the great powers. Why should we accept the Australian government view that Britain and the US were violating the principles of the UN? Because Britain and the US, along with Canada and the smaller Western European powers, asserted that this Western Union, if you like, NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, that this was necessary in order to defend these very principles against a new totalitarian aggressor, that is, the Soviet Union. Secondly, remember, Evatt had no compunction whatsoever about seeking a partisan alliance for the protection of Australian interests in the Pacific. Indeed, he'd worked feverishly for that end in 1946 and 1947. Thirdly, why should the Australians blame the Americans for this British proposal to unite the West against the Soviet Union? There's no question it was an initiative of the British Labor government of Clement Attlee. Indeed, the British recognised they had a hard task in convincing the Americans to join in an alliance which would underwrite the security of Western Europe. Now, the answer to all these questions I'm raising is not that the Labor policymakers of the late 1940s were crypto-communists. That's what the chargé d'affaires of the American embassy in Canberra said back to Washington. The answer is that I think they saw in this initiative of the British government a danger to their security policy in the Pacific. If the permanence of the tensions between the Western powers and the Soviet Union were accepted, as this British proposal seemed to imply, then Britain and America would once more have to concentrate their defence resources in Europe. They would once again put Europe first, and this might well leave Australia vulnerable. So at the end of his reply to Clement Attlee, Chifley told him, he said,
"Australia's interests were very much bound up in the Pacific area. In the event of European conflict, our whole manpower might well have to be diverted to the protection of our position and interests in this area."
Australia's position was precarious, he said.
"There is no government in the Southeast Asia or Pacific areas which is stable. Every government can be prevailed upon to adopt a policy hostile to us if it so suited powers engaged in a European conflict.
That is not the language of liberal internationalism. It's not an application of the principles of the United Nations Charter, as the Australians define them. That is a single-minded concern for Australia's own national security. Now, by the end of 1948, the Australians had reconsidered their position. The division between the East and West did seem to be irreversible. The Soviet Union's blockade of the British and American sectors of Berlin increased international tension. Many feared it might preview the beginning of a Third World War. At a Commonwealth Prime Minister's Conference, when the British PM appealed to the Dominions for help in global planning against Soviet expansionism, Australia was the most forthcoming. It agreed that the Soviets did pose the greatest threat to world peace and were prepared to join in global defence arrangements to deter and contain the enemy. However, when the British followed this up with a request to begin this planning immediately, because they looked forward to be able to use Australian military forces in the Middle East, Chifley replied that Australia was not willing to send any forces out of the region unless it first had an ironclad US guarantee for its security in the Pacific, comparable to that which NATO gave Britain in Europe. Following the signing of the NATO Treaty, the Australians, again feeling rather lonely and friendless in the world, again approached the Americans about a Pacific Pact. At the time, the Americans had no interest in making such a commitment. Moreover, President Truman had had much difficulty in persuading Congress to set aside their established principle of no entangling alliances. His administration did not relish taking on Congress again for a cause which lacked at that point the imperative of the European rationale. Now let's move on to the signing of the ANZUS Pact, a matter of enduring significance for Australian foreign and defence policy. The ANZUS Treaty, which was signed in September 1951, was negotiated by the Menzies Liberal Country Party government that came to power in December of 1949. Their success was not due to superior diplomacy, but to dramatic international developments. In 1949, the Chinese Communist Revolution had triumphed. Coming to power, they had almost immediately entered into an alliance with the Soviet Union. In June 1950, the communist North Koreans had invaded South Korea. The whole region seemed to be affected by communist insurgency movements. As a result, the Americans decided that they should construct an alliance, comparable to NATO, for the purpose of containing the spread of communism in the region. And initially, they had in mind uniting the island nations of the east coast of Asia, that is, Japan, the Philippines, Australia and New Zealand, and even possibly Indonesia, which had just won its independence from the Dutch. But they found that these countries were still too suspicious of Japan, and Australia suspicious of Indonesia, to make this feasible. Consequently, the Americans settled for bilateral, and in the case of Australia and New Zealand, a trilateral alliance. Now, the central provision of the ANZUS Treaty, which was signed in September 1951, is to be found in Article 4, which states that the parties will recognise that an armed attack on any one of the signatories would be regarded as dangerous to the peace and safety of all, and that they would act to meet the common danger in accordance with their constitutional processes. It also provided for the establishment of a council of the party's foreign ministers which could meet to discuss common problems and issues. What Percy Spender, Australia's chief negotiator, had failed to achieve, however, was access to America's global planning. Australia had been alarmed that they had given priority to Europe. It was Spender's hope to use the treaty to gain access to Pentagon global planning and decision-making. The Americans would have none of it. The US would not allow small allies to complicate processes and policies for which it was responsible, and Australia had to make do with what the Americans offered. But what had been achieved was what Australian leaders from Deakin through Lyons to Chifley had desired, namely a public commitment by the US to Australian security. Let me make three general points about the US alliance. The first is, this is the first time that Australia and New Zealand had entered into a treaty of major significance to which the British were not also a party. Now, the British had not been sympathetic to the American plan for Far East security since it did not cover their colonies on the mainland of Asia. They tried to discourage the Americans from moving too precipitately to agree to ANZUS. And when they failed, they began to press for membership. The Churchill government saw Britain's exclusion as a blow to its imperial prestige. The Americans would not agree, and so the Australians, while in accord with their traditional ties to Britain, would have been willing to include it, had no choice but to go along with the Americans. As we've already seen with the Chifley Labor government, it was America's protection which was vital to Australian survival. So even the British raised patriot feelings and traditional ties could be sacrificed for this. The second general point is the consensus in the Australian political community that ANZUS is a good thing. And from the beginning, this was the case. The Australian government, as part of the price for the treaty, had to agree, even if reluctantly, to a soft peace for Japan. But when the two treaties came before Parliament for ratification, the Labor Party joined the government in supporting the ANZUS treaty, but it voted against the Japanese peace treaty. At no time has any political party advocated the abrogation of the ANZUS treaty. Australia could not contemplate following New Zealand and risking, as New Zealand did, its membership in the alliance by refusing to allow nuclear-powered or armed ships to enter its ports. ANZUS has become the sacred cow of Australian foreign policy. There have been some arguments about how it should be understood and what concessions Australia needed to make to the US as its great power protector, and those arguments are ongoing. But for more than 70 years, under many different circumstances and different governments, it has remained an unquestionable first principle of Australia's foreign policy. But bear this in mind, the third point. It might be asked, what does ANZUS mean for Australia? John Foster Dulles, America's chief negotiator of the treaty at the end of the process, wrote to General Douglas MacArthur in Tokyo that the US, he said, under the terms of ANZUS could
discharge its obligations in any way and in any area that it sees fit.
That is, he didn't see it, that it bound America to take any action to come to Australia's assistance under any given circumstance. Certainly, as we'll see later in this series, Australian governments on not a few occasions have felt let down and ignored by the Americans when issues vital to Australia's regional security were at stake. So what then has been the value of the alliance to Australia? I suppose the answer to that question would have to be that it has been a symbol or a sign to the region that Australia has a special relationship to the United States and that that should be taken into account in any hostile attitude or action which might be contemplated. The only major concession which Australia felt obliged to make to the US to keep the alliance in good shape was to refuse to give diplomatic recognition to Communist China. The United States resented deeply the Communist victory in China. It regarded the People's Republic, in contemporary parlance, as a rogue state. It treated it as a pariah regime and encouraged all its allies to deny it international recognition. Britain had recognised the Chinese Communists very shortly after they assumed power. It seems clear from the documents that Australia, under the Menzies government, was intending to follow Britain's lead. But since the Americans placed so much store on isolating China, Australia deferred to America. It should be pointed out that America's policy towards communist China was based on an ideological worldview. It would not countenance any relationship with the regime. It would not allow its citizens to travel or trade with the country. And as a result of its trade boycott, it denied itself access to the Great China market. This sacrifice was all the more marked in that most of its Western allies continued to trade and trade profitably with China. And indeed, Australia was among that group of Western allies. Indeed, the Country Party, which used the most anti-communist language for domestic political purposes, was also adamant that politics and trade should not be connected. During the Vietnam War, BHP continued to export steel to China, which, according to the government's justification for entering the war, lay behind that war. But Australia, unlike the United States, did not see the problems of the world primarily in ideological terms, at least in this period. Menzies might make speeches about Christ and the Antichrist, but he was quite the opportunist in his defence policy. So that is, while the United States and Britain conscripted into the army all its young men for terms of 2 years, and while those countries spent 7 to 10% of their GDP on defence, Australia, and only for a short time, had a 3-month call-up for only a proportion of 18-year-old youths, and spent only on average 3 to 4% of GDP on defence in the 1950s. Since its great and powerful friends, as Menzies referred to Britain and America, since they, for their own reasons, were protecting the region, and thereby Australia from any possible aggression, Australia had no need to provide in a serious way for its own defence. It was willing to make a modest contribution to forward defence in cooperation with its allies, but it saw no need to sacrifice internal development for defence build-ups, even though its great and powerful friends complained, often, that Australia was not pulling its weight in Western defence. One of the major tasks for Australian diplomacy and strategy was to try to bridge differences over policy, such as the acceptance of the 1954 Vietnam Accords, by which the French agreed to a division of Vietnam. The Americans, seeing this as another victory for communism, were unwilling to concede even the North to Ho Chi Minh and his communist peasants. The British, on the other hand, saw it as the only possible resolution of the problem. Australia tried to stand in the middle, though it was most embarrassing when the great and powerful friends disagreed. Australia was the greatest enthusiast for an American proposal which was to form a Southeast Asian alliance that would supposedly hold the line against further communist advances in the region. Australia saw at last that their great and powerful friends were linking their respective security spheres, America in the Western Pacific and Britain in Southeast Asia. So the two sides of the northern frontier were being brought together. But the Southeast Asian Treaty Organisation, or CETO, was, however, as the Chinese dubbed it, something of a paper tiger. It was in no sense a regional alliance. It did not include major regional partners such as Indonesia. Of its members, three were Western powers from outside the region. France had had its fingers burnt and had no further serious interest in the region. Britain's own limits were becoming clear, and when the first challenge came in South Vietnam, it opted not to participate in that war. Pakistan, though remote from the region, was admitted in order to give the organisation a more Asian look to it, but that is all it offered. Thailand and the Philippines were small client states of the US. Australia and New Zealand were, even if within the region, Western powers, and their power was quite small. The US, which did not belong to the region alone, gave substance to the treaty. Actions were taken in CETO's name, but only three or four members supported those actions. It's difficult to see what CETO added to the security of the region, apart from the appearance of a collective resistance to communism. But it did remain formally in being until the mid-1970s. By the end of the 1950s, Australia had a sense that in the future they could not expect effective help from Britain in the case of a major threat to their territory. Everything would depend on the US. And to this end, the Australians reorganised their military structures and armaments to fit those of the US armed forces. It was in association with those forces that they saw the pattern of their future defence. Furthermore, they saw the need to integrate America's defence needs with Australia, so that American authorities would come to see the defence of Australia as being assimilated to the defence of America. In the 1960s, they therefore welcomed American proposals to establish intelligence facilities on Australian soil. In 1962, the Menzies government approved the setting up at Northwest Cape in Western Australia, was known as a very low frequency, or VLF, naval communications station, which was able to transmit orders to Polaris-armed submarines in the Indian Ocean. Later, two further stations were established. One at Woomera was connected to the American satellites, which gave early warning of missile attacks, and the other, at Pine Gap near Alice Springs, was connected to orbiting satellites which collected Soviet and Chinese radio transmissions. So looking back, we can see how Australians at the end of the Second World War continued their efforts to obtain great power protection against possible threats from Asia, firstly Japan and then Communist China. By the accidents of the Cold War, Australia had received the kind of protection it had long sought. It appreciated as a result of the Second World War experience that only a US defence arrangement or alliance would be adequate. And it was for this reason that the Menzies government was willing, when the Americans offered them the opportunity, to join in an alliance without the participation of Britain. That said, it must be admitted that British mass nationalism still defined public culture. And during the 1950s, the Australian governments remained much more intimately bound to Great Britain than to the United States. And this was true of foreign and defence policy. Britain was still, even if a fading, world power. In its endeavours to put down the communist insurgency in Malaya, it had stationed a greater military force in the region than at any previous time in its history. And it had little price to pay for it. But Britain's humiliation over the Suez Canal crisis in 1956 raised serious questions about its international standing and its future as its empire disappeared. Britain's decision to apply for membership of the European Economic Community from 1961 to 63, remember that was the one where the French President Charles de Gaulle said, "Non, you're not able to enter." But this was a decisive point for Australian awareness of the need to rethink its identity and its future. It was not the loss of British markets that caused this painful reappraisal. Rather, it was Britain's decision to turn its back on the worldwide British community and seek its destiny in Europe. This, like all the previous failures to make the idea of one British world work, could not be explained away or be solved by better communications or consultations or Australian Prime Ministers beating a path to London, asking them to set up more consultative councils. There was an absoluteness about that British decision to enter Europe which could not be misinterpreted. Faced with this, Australia began to remake itself. America increasingly was its West. And certainly the alliance was the first consideration for Australia's foreign and defence policy. But even more, the collapse of the British race ideal caused Australia to become more preoccupied and in new ways with its region. In the next episode, as I said, we're going to look at another key ingredient in this period, and that is how Australia responded to the Asian national independence movements in the context of the Cold War. Thanks for listening. We'd also like to acknowledge the Indigenous peoples for over 60,000 years who lived on, loved and dreamt about the lands on which I'm speaking today, and I pay my respects to their present and future successors who continue to embody their affection for Australia and their enthusiasm for its well-being. This series is produced by Peter Adams for the School of Humanities at the University of Sydney.